Welcome to Agency of the Month, Department of Homeland Security, sponsored by Leidos. Here's your host, Jason Miller.
My guest today is Claire Grady, the Undersecretary for Management at the Homeland Security Department, who's also performing the duties of Deputy Secretary at DHS. Claire, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you so much, Jason, for the opportunity.
So this is part of a ongoing look at the Homeland Security Department over the last 15 years. You know, 15-year anniversary, there's a lot going on, a lot has changed. I know you were relatively new to the Homeland Security Department, generally speaking. You came over from the Defense Department. But give me a sense, this idea of togetherness and the way DHS has really formed into a more cohesive agency. Talk a little bit about what you're seeing as you begin your tenure at DHS.
Absolutely. I had the pleasure of serving at DHS headquarters almost 10 years ago, and then at the Coast Guard, which is a component of DHS, for 8 years. And coming back after a extended period of time away from DHS headquarters and looking across the components, it really is remarkable in terms of the progress that's been made. When you look across that, the unity of effort across the department and the department functioning as a department as opposed to a collection of components has just been tremendous. I think sometimes people who have been here every day don't always recognize just how much progress we've made. When I look at things like the standing up of the Joint Requirements Council or standing up the Joint Task Forces, it really does look across and draw on the expertise across the department to deliver our mission in a most efficient and effective way. And the department really has stepped up in a big way, considering how young it is compared to other departments across the government.
So one thing, as you talk about the Joint Requirements Council and the Joint Task Forces, those things are relatively new. But at the same time, as you said, as you step away and can come back, you see it in a different light. What also stands out to you as something that is really part of that togetherness? I mean, it's one thing to say, well, we brought people together and they meet every Monday, and that's great. But something has to come from that meeting that's in that togetherness role that's, I'll use the word cohesive again.
Absolutely. And so those were some of the bigger examples in terms of more institutional structures that were brought to bear. But it's also all the little things on the day-to-day. And by little, I don't mean to minimize the progress, but things like DHS-wide hiring fairs. This summer, we sponsored a hiring fair where we had all of the components represented, as well as the operational and headquarters. And the two-day hiring event, which was oriented towards veterans, we had almost 2,500 applicants. We had every component participating. We were doing interviews on the spot. We did 647 interviews, and 147 tentative job offers were made over the course of those 2 days. And it was just incredible to see the entire department represented, talking about the missions, talking about how the missions are complementary, and looking at skill sets that we needed and tapping into a universe or a population that is obviously oriented towards serving our nation. So we were looking to see if they would serve in a different capacity as part of our DHS workforce. But just when I looked around that room, it was incredible to see just how it was no longer everybody had their own individual perspective. It really was a department perspective with individual missions contributing. So that things like that I see as huge steps forward, as well as when we look at some of the efforts across the country, where we look at field efficiencies, where we've looked at things as simple as sharing warehouse space. Those are real tangible progress associated with everybody doesn't have to have their own. And we can look across and look at capability and capacity across the department and take advantage of what we as a department can bring to bear and make sure that we're maximizing the value of the dollars the taxpayers are investing in our department. So just little things and big things, I see it every day as I walk around the department and the components.
It's interesting you brought up something like warehouse, you bring up something like the hiring fair. I mean, simple things like that, as you said, make such a big difference. Maybe, you know, when you were there, you know, 10 years ago, if ICE said, hey, we're trying to hire some law enforcement officers, and Customs and Border Protection may have said, okay, have fun, bye, we have our own thing. And now there's this view that, like, hey, we all could benefit, you know, with kind of the rising tide lifts all boats. Do you think that change has happened because of a maturity, or did something or something kind of click over the last decade plus where people said, hey, we have to stop doing this individual thing and do this joint thing because that's the way we'll all get better?
I think it was a combination, and it definitely took concentrated, focused leadership to say we need to look as a department And when I say leadership, I'm not saying just the headquarters leadership. It's the leadership at all of the components who look at the opportunities, who look at Homeland Security as an ecosystem and realize how interdependent everything we do is. So looking at how do we deliver our mission better by utilizing and maximizing our resources across the department. So I really think it's both leadership, realization of the opportunity, some successes that we saw, as well as the trust and confidence that, quite frankly, sometimes you just need some time for people to get used to being part of a new department.
I'm speaking with Claire Grady, the Undersecretary for Management at the Homeland Security Department, who is also performing the duties of the Deputy Secretary for Homeland Security Department.
I'm Jason Miller, and you're listening to Agency of the Month on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
For 15 years, Leidos has seen firsthand the Department of Homeland Security's men and women safeguard the American people, our homeland, and our values. In support of the DHS mission, our technical experts have delivered trusted solutions in mission-based IT, cybersecurity, biometrics, and logistics. Ranked number one on Washington Technology's top 100, Leidos has the experience DHS can count on, and we're ready for your future missions. Learn more at Leidos.com/homeland.
Welcome back. You're listening to Agency of the Month on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller.
I'm speaking with Claire Grady, the Undersecretary for Management at the Homeland Security Department, who is also performing the duties of the Deputy Secretary for Homeland Security Department. Let's talk about one area that I think DHS maybe has struggled a little bit with, and this is around acquisition. You came over from the Defense Department where you spent, you know, a good part of your time there in the acquisition world. And one of the things about DHS that I think they are still room to grow is around more uniform acquisition, buying different things, whether it's for the Coast Guard or for CBP or even just general administrative. Talk a little bit about how that is happening in a better way. I think you mentioned one piece of that earlier, the Joint Requirements Council. Talk a little bit more about that plus other initiatives.
Well, I mean, the department still gets a bit of a bad rap about acquisition because of some early missteps. And there's no question when the department was standing up, we needed to mature our acquisition processes. A big part of that was standing up and growing our acquisition workforce. When I first came to the department, we had precisely three certified categories of acquisition professionals: contracting officers, program managers, and contracting officer representatives. We now have 13 different specialties that mirror DoD's acquisition professions, things like systems engineers, logisticians, business financial managers, the whole spectrum of capability that you need to successfully deliver capability to the field. I think that has made a huge difference in terms of the investments the department has strategically made over time in our acquisition workforce to make sure we have professionals with the qualifications, experience, and training to handle the acquisition programs that we're entrusted to run. That having that capability and capacity has made a huge difference, as well as putting the infrastructure in place to make sure that we have policy and guidance relative to what our expectations are for acquisition programs. We are not as big as DoD, but there is a sizable acquisition portfolio that we manage, and we have tailored our acquisition processes appropriately so we have adequate insight and oversight into what's going on in our acquisition programs to make sure that things are going on track, and if they are starting to veer from their intended course, we have an opportunity to take corrective action and make sure we're addressing the risks as they materialize. All the acquisition programs have baselines now. They have schedules, things that may seem sort of fundamental, but given the urgency with which the department stood up, that didn't always happen back in the early days of the department. And those days are long gone. There is discipline across the system, and we have appropriate controls and qualified professionals running the programs.
And I think that's one of the biggest differences that I've seen covering DHS for the last 15 years plus is the bringing in this culture that's very similar to the military. And if you look at, for instance, former Secretary Jay Johnson had a military background. A current Deputy Undersecretary for Management, Chip Fulgham, is a retired military officer. Do you think, and obviously your experience with DoD as well, do you think that was what helped, I don't want to say right the ship, but to say that helped bringing in that established, understood discipline and then bringing in people behind it who have experienced the success of that discipline, has that been one of the big difference makers?
I think it has helped, and certainly when we stood up our acquisition workforce, we definitely hired away from a bunch of other agencies, including DOD, which is the single largest agency when it comes to acquisition workforce, which makes sense because they obligate about 65% of the dollars across the federal government. But taking advantage of that expertise and bringing people in with experience, because quite frankly, acquisition is difficult. It is challenging to deliver state-of-the-art or state-of-the-market capabilities on time, on schedule, to meet end users' requirements. And you need those battle scars to have lived through and delivered capability and know what challenges you're going to encounter, as opposed to just studying them. And then also, I think the advantage of having some individuals with defense experience was recognizing that DHS is not DOD, but some of the discipline associated with those processes are appropriate, if tailored, to apply to our DHS acquisitions. So we didn't try and replicate DOD, but we learned from DOD in a big way.
Were you surprised when you came over back to DHS from DOD about how similar things are?
The framework that we're using from an acquisition perspective was very similar, and it was tailored based on DOD. So it didn't necessarily surprise me. Now, I was only gone for the last about 3 years. I was at Coast Guard working acquisition, so there wasn't a dramatic change in those 3 years when I left. But it was interesting to see DOD and where they're going, and see DHS where they're going. And I'll be honest, even when I was at Coast Guard, we were stealing good ideas from DOD, and DHS was doing it, Coast Guard was doing it. And so we keep abreast of what's going on across the federal space and take advantage of good ideas wherever those might come from.
And let's not underestimate the importance of sharing and collaboration and communicating and having those people that came over and then have the reach back into DOD. Like, I know, for instance, your experience at DPAP, if you had to call Shay Assad over there and say, "Hey, Shay, I'm having trouble with this, help me out," knowing that past relationship also makes a big difference too.
Oh, having the ability to phone a friend and also to collaborate and check with others to see what challenges they have, I think that's a tremendous strength of the DHS workforce, not just in acquisition, but not just with DOD, but we have talented individuals who have come from a variety of federal agencies, and they bring over best practices and from across the federal government, and not just in acquisition, but across the enterprise. And I think that's a tremendous strength that DHS has, is a willingness to look at how do we improve what we're doing, and looking at different options in terms of delivery of services or achievement of capabilities.
Do you get a sense that's also one of the biggest differences between now and 15 years ago, is that when the agencies were coming together, they were all individual, and they all maybe felt, well, people in the acquisition world at least, felt, well, my process is the best process and your process is not my process, so therefore I really don't want to listen to it. Now there's that different type of acceptance, there's the different type of viewpoint that, yeah, we can learn from other people, and maybe some of that is the turnover of people, but also it's the maturity of it all.
I think that definitely contributes. I also think that there was just such a sense of urgency to deliver capability when the department was first stood up, because we were dealing with a threat, a very real threat that had materialized on 9/11 that no one knew when that next attack was going to occur, and we needed to do everything humanly possible to get ready as quickly as possible. While we certainly still have a tremendous sense of urgency, there's the realization that thinking through what the actual requirements are and making sure that those are well understood and that we can afford to both buy and operate and maintain those capabilities is the discipline that's come into the process, and people recognize the value of following a more disciplined process. But I also think your point about ability to tap into and willingness to look at things from different perspectives on what worked. I think there's much more of that, but I also think a little bit of that is due to less of a desperate sense of urgency, I would say, because absolutely everybody recognizes what we are in a tremendously risk-driven environment. The nation is, quite frankly, is subject to threats from across the spectrum, and we need to be constantly vigilant and constantly upping our game. So the urgency still remains, but people recognize following a disciplined process will deliver capability that's more effective and quicker to the end users if we have that discipline.
My guest today is Claire Grady, the Undersecretary for Management at the Homeland Security Department, who's also performing the duties of Deputy Secretary at DHS.
I'm Jason Miller, and you're listening to Agency of the Month on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
For 15 years, Leidos has seen firsthand the Department of Homeland Security's men and women safeguard the American people, our homeland, and our values. In support of the DHS mission, our technical experts have delivered trusted solutions in mission-based IT, cybersecurity, biometrics, and logistics. Ranked number one on Washington Technology's top 100, Leidos has the experience DHS can count on, and we're ready for your future missions. Learn more at Leidos.com/homeland.
Welcome back. You're listening to Agency of the Month on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller.
My guest today is Claire Grady, the Undersecretary for Management at the Homeland Security Department, who's also performing the duties of Deputy Secretary at DHS. Now, Claire, the other piece I want to talk a little bit about, we talked a little bit about acquisition. The other piece of this, obviously, is modernization, because acquisition falls right into that idea of, okay, we have these systems that we brought over the last 15 years, from maybe, and many could be more than 15 years old, they could be 20, 30, 40 years old. How do you modernize? So talk broadly about this modernization effort that's going on, not just in DHS, but really across all of government.
So I think one of the things that we're doing that's smart relative to modernization is we are not just approaching modernization as a system perspective. We are really looking hard at our business processes and how we deliver services. Are there more efficient ways to work through the services that we deliver? Are there better ways to approach things with the speed that technology is advancing? To replicate traditional processes may not be the best approach. To automate existing processes may not be our best answer. So one of the things that we're looking at is not just how we can leverage technology and how we can modernize the systems we have, but how do we, as a department, function to deliver those services and ask them the hard questions about, well, what's the best way to accomplish that? So I think that taking that holistic approach is really beneficial. And obviously, the IT infrastructure, we do have some aging systems, as you pointed out. We do need to look at how we modernize those, but we are looking at modernization, not just replacement, not just investment in old technology, but we're looking at what is it we really need to do our jobs, not just today, but in the future, and looking to take advantage of opportunities that are presented by that question.
As you go through this relook or this modernization of the processes, how's that being done? Because what I think it comes down to, and we see this across many different agencies, is CBP, for instance, has a case management system. ICE has a case management system. We could create the system side of this, one case management system, but then how do the processes, do we find that they're 80% the same, 90% the same? And if so, that really lessens the need for potential two modernization projects. It can bring, one in a quarter modernization projects, which is much cheaper and can happen much more quickly. How are you working on that business process reengineering effort?
Well, so there are a couple different ways. One is in terms of looking holistically, and we just looked at our agency reorganization and modernization and looked at opportunities. And also through the Joint Retirement Requirements Council, we're looking at and saying, okay, like the example you gave was case management. Who else has case management requirements? Can we come up with a common core capability to meet those needs? And all of our requirements are now going through the JRC to look for and leverage those opportunities where we might have common needs, recognizing that it might not be a 100% solution, but an 80% solution may be what we need and what we can deliver more quickly. And then we have some interoperability associated with things. For financial systems, we sort of came to a conclusion that there's some combination of modernization and collapsing, and some combination of just integration across the systems and making sure the systems can talk to each other. We don't necessarily all have to be on the same system to operate effectively, but we do need to be able to pull data from systems, have it reliably transfer in and inform our decisions. So we need real-time access to data that is integrated across the department, not necessarily just single up on a single system. But we're asking those questions and saying what makes sense for us, given where we are and given where we're trying to go, what investments are necessary to get there, and which are we going to prioritize.
So I covered the financial management hearing that just happened and, and the relationship with the Interior Business Center that you guys decided to end a little bit early. Do you feel like in that the financial management system effort is better and has a better vision, has a better path now? Because, you know, as I've covered this over the years, one of the biggest challenges I've seen is getting everyone on the same page. And I think one of the areas of that that you guys struggled with Interior is not having the one, if you will, belly button to push to say, this is the path we are going down. And you know, you had Coast Guard had their path and TSA had their path and DNDO had their path and nobody had, they weren't necessarily going down. They were maybe on the same road, but maybe not the same lane. And that caused a little bit more challenges than you guys maybe hoped for. Do you believe that you brought them all together and they're all heading down not only the same path, but the same lane now?
I believe we're all on the same path. It's perhaps not an identical lane, but all in the same path, all headed the same direction. I think our financial modernization effort with Department of Interior, DHS is a large agency, and the volume of transactions that we process from a financial perspective on any year dwarfs what a lot of other agencies do. And so I think one of the challenges we had was just a matter of scale and communicating the scale that we have. Definitely in terms of harmonizing the requirements and making sure that we're looking at not customization, but we're looking at configuration of existing software products. So we want to minimize customization to the greatest extent possible because that is what's going to drive our lifecycle costs. But within a financial system product, and there are a lot of them, the ability to configure those products to meet our needs is pretty robust now. And that's an area where the commercial industry has really grown in terms of the available products. So I really think that we're in a good place in terms of moving forward. The investments we made with Department of Interior are going to put us in good stead as we move forward, and we are taking the work that we did with Department of Interior, putting it in a different hosting environment, but we are still continuing to take advantage of and benefit from the work we had done with them.
Claire, this has been a fascinating conversation. I think we could talk a lot longer, but unfortunately, I think we're almost out of time. So before I let you go, if we have this conversation again in 15 years and if we're both still around and doing our jobs, talk a little bit about what's still going to change. Where is DHS going to be, you know, if we talk again in 15 years?
So I think when we talk again in 15 years, I think we'll be looking at DHS facing any number of challenges because the threats are ever evolving, but we're going to have a workforce that is agile and adaptable and able to respond, and we're going to be using information very effectively to make sure that we are responding in a manner to counter any of those threats and to respond to and recover from those. So what I see is the department just continuing to grow in terms of capabilities and professionalism. And we have an incredibly talented workforce, and they're a workforce that I would love to see in 15 years what they will have accomplished.
Excellent. You and I will both get to watch it go along. It's been a fascinating 15 years. I'd like to thank my guest, Claire Grady, the Undersecretary for Management at Homeland Security Department, and who's also performing the duties of the Deputy Secretary. Claire, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Jason. I really appreciated the time and the conversation.
That's all the time we have for today. I've been your host, Jason Miller, and you've been listening to Agency of the Month on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Thank you for listening to Agency of the Month, Department of Homeland Security, sponsored by Leidos on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. The entire program can be found on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search DHS15.
Technology's changing the way we live our lives, and at Kaiser Permanente, we mean that quite literally. See, our doctors have experience with technology that changes lives every day. Our members have access to the cutting-edge medical findings of diverse research teams, and that means you could be among the first to experience the latest breakthroughs in medicine. At Kaiser Permanente, we live and breathe the latest in medical technology to help keep our members living and breathing. Visit kp.org today.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852. The Federal News Radio Community Spotlight is the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. Did you know that LLS's impact is beyond blood cancer? Many treatments LLS has advanced and which were approved by the FDA for blood cancers are now helping patients with other cancers and chronic diseases. LLS is the best investment you can make. Your support saves lives, enables critical research and patient programs. Get involved. LLS.org/NCA. Read more about the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society at federalnewsradio.com. Search partners.
Welcome to the Innovation in Government Show, sponsored by Carisoft. Each month, we'll talk with industry experts who enable innovation and make government more responsive and secure by advancing key technologies. Now, here's your host, Jason Miller.
Before we get started, let me set some context for our discussion. White House Special Assistant to the President Matt Lehrer recently was asked at a conference, "What are your top priorities?" Lehrer, whose main job is working for the Office of American Innovation, said simply, "Technology and fixing their underlying processes." He then expounded a little further, saying, "We need to improve citizen-facing experiences. If we don't fix those underlying processes, then we are just putting a Band-Aid on a wound." It's an interesting response for several reasons from Matt Lehrer. First of all, the White House's draft IT modernization strategy has a strong cyber flavor, but it includes no mention of citizen services or the improvement of those citizen services. Now, comments on that draft were due in late September, so OAI, OMB are now reviewing industry and others' input, so it could be a few more months until we see a final strategy and see what changes come, especially around citizen services. In the meantime, agencies continue to go down a well-worn path to move off legacy technology and onto modern platforms. Agencies are expected to spend more than $2 billion on cloud computing this year, and that figure is only expected to increase as agencies go to cloud in the coming years. The Departments of Commerce, Homeland Security, and Treasury are the top three civilian agencies who are buying cloud services, according to the State of Federal IT report from the CIO Council that was published in January of 2017. And there's still plenty of opportunity around cloud, too. OMB set a government-wide goal of 15% of all agency systems to be in the cloud, and according to that January report, no agency has reached that mark yet. But it's more than just moving to the cloud. It's relooking at the business processes behind these mission areas and how can they be optimized to serve the citizen better. And that's where data analytics, a strong eye toward mobility, and of course, the use of Agile or DevOps all can play huge roles. So how can agencies bring all these initiatives together? Well, that's why we have our guests today. They're going to tell us everything they know. Once again, my guests are Laura Grant, the head of digital innovation for public sector at SAP, and David Vernon, the senior human capital management application specialist at SAP. Let me turn to Laura first and get a little bit of understanding about this IT modernization effort. What are some of those trends that you're seeing around technology modernization?
When we talk about IT modernization, it's important for the government customers that we're talking to really understand this is that opportunity to not just modernize the systems. It's more than just upgrading those systems, moving off of legacy systems, repeating the same look and feel of the legacy system in a new, more modern software package. This is a perfect opportunity for the customers to rethink those business processes. How do you take a business process that is maybe 10 steps today and get that down to 2 steps? The agencies are really expected to do more with less. So this is a great opportunity for them to rethink those business processes, make them more efficient, automate those. And then once they're able to do that, then they should also think about, is this modernization effort, is this an innovation platform that I can continue to modernize with down the road? Because technology is changing so rapidly, you have to think about those technologies that are going to let you bring in new functionality down the road and new innovations that we can't even imagine today. So I think it's kind of twofold, thinking about those innovation technologies that are coming in, but also rethinking the business processes. So some of those innovations, you know, things that are coming into the enterprise and into the business processes are machine learning, artificial intelligence, blockchain, chatbots, bringing chatbots into the enterprise. We have digital assistants at home. Why not have those in the enterprise? Why not talk to your financial system? Why not talk to your supply chain system, your HR system? These chatbots leveraging machine learning will then become kind of smart assistants. So as you ask questions of your chatbot over time, the intelligence will step in and start telling you information that they know or that they think you might want to have access to and act upon. So that is really what should be considered as a part of this modernization effort, thinking about not just modernization, but is this an innovative platform that we can leverage in a rapid, agile way going forward?
So there's a couple of things. Let me pull on the strings a little bit there. I wrote a story just in the last month or month and a half or so about lift and shift. Are you basically saying lift and shift maybe is okay for some things, but that should not be the only thing you're doing? That shouldn't be the only vision you have from an agency perspective?
Absolutely. It really should be taking advantage of this opportunity to simplify some of those processes. Some of those processes have been around for 30, 40 years. I would challenge every agency to ask why you're doing some of those steps and what's the outcome that's expected. And is there a way to do that in an automated fashion versus just repeating those processes in a new system? This is a perfect opportunity to actually bring the analytics into the same system with the transactions. And what the value of this is from the functional community perspective is you now, from a financials perspective, no longer need to do trial balances, no longer need to do as many reconciliations. You've got all of these systems together in one spot with the analytics. So the time spent doing the countless hours of time spent doing reconciliation, month end, quarter end, year end closes and trial balances will go away. We're talking about closing every day. The transactions are live. The analytics are live. So when there's a huge business process change happening right now, and the government can really take advantage of this and really save a lot of manpower hours. Because again, like I said, they're really being asked to do so much more with less resources. And this is one of the ways that they'll be able to do that. From a supply chain perspective, there's a lot of time spent in the planning process, weeks and sometimes months in planning. When you have your analytics in the same system as your supply chain system, you can do planning every single day. You're no longer planning based on old information. You're planning in real time, and you're really running the government in a live situation. You've got real information.
I want to bring David into the conversation. David, one thing that Laura talked about was chatbots for HR. Now, your specialty is around the human resources side. Talk a little bit about where you're seeing this modernization effort bleed into the HR side. We can talk workforce all day, but from a technology, from a, if you will, a business process side.
From the federal standpoint, we're not seeing chatbots yet, but we are seeing a big push to the social networking and more communications going on between the actual employees and the management staff to get them more engaged and to get them more productive and make them feel like they're more part of the organization. So we see that move down there. Now, Laura gave me an example yesterday that I thought was to die for. It's like Alexa, you know, Alexa and Siri. And to be able to walk into your office as a human resources specialist and say, Alexa, give me my headcount as of today, and that would be able to do that. That's where we're looking, and that's where we're going, and that's where I see HR can take advantage of a lot of these things that are coming down the road.
And one thing, when you talk about Alexa walking in, and or not walking in, but you're walking in and asking Alexa, right, or Siri or whoever, what is the today's headcount, you also can help you plan, meaning if you take advantage, if you see someone who's been absent multiple days, oh, is there something going on in that person's life that we should know about? It gives HR a much richer idea of what's happening with the workforce, and that means better morale, hopefully. It means better productivity, too.
Absolutely. And when you think of that, having that capability, understanding that I came from an era that everything was pen and paper, and to have that ability to get to that information or to do that planning and to bring in the worker into the organization that tight-knit, I think it is a major that we're going to see coming down the road.
From a human resource perspective as well, one of the things that we already have available today is leveraging machine learning to remove bias in the recruiting process, as well as doing resume matching. So two very manual processes today that happen in the HR community, and leveraging machine learning to automate that. So some huge advantages there.
Well, you almost stole my question, because I was going to ask, what are some of those trends that are starting to emerge, maybe on that cutting edge a little bit, when you talk about AI and machine learning, and you talk about even something like chatbots, are agencies yet asking for these things, or they're not just quite there yet?
They're asking a lot of questions around this. They're starting to do a lot of exploration. They're information seekers. So we're having a lot of conversations on this. I would say what's really a buzz right now is blockchain, and the customers are really trying to understand what those use cases are, how does it work, what does this mean, which is interesting because it's allowing us to change the conversation around the business processes. When you're using a technology like blockchain, you really explore the existing process and how blockchain could really, really change some of that. So same thing with like machine learning. You're seeing machine learning kind of creep into our personal life. It almost is sneaking in there, and you're going to see the same thing happen in the enterprise systems. It's just going to start being embedded in these technologies that are truly innovating. And all of a sudden, you're not even going to realize it, but there's machine learning behind the scene, you know, really making your job easier.
One of the interesting things you talk about when blockchain, and I've been to several conferences over the last month or so, and that seems to be a pretty hot topic. Let's just give our audience a quick definition of blockchain. It's one of those new technologies I'm not sure people know about. It's really all about ensuring identity. It's ensuring authentication. Just give us the 50,000 foot view.
Right. So blockchain is leveraging a distributed ledger of information across a network in a trusted fashion. And I think that's why it's so appealing. When there's a lack of trust and a need for a network, this is really an interesting technology to use. And the use cases continue to build. But I see a huge push in the federal government. Usually the government is a laggard in adapting technology. But with blockchain, I wouldn't say they're the complete on the forefront, but they're definitely considering it for several use cases.
So we could have said the same thing about IPv6, and unfortunately that fizzled around, but we won't get into that. David, let me ask you a similar question. When you look at trends in the HR, human capital, human resources world, when it comes to this modernization push, again, it doesn't necessarily have to be technology, but some things that are enabled by technology, what are some of those modernization trends you're starting to see across the government?
We're just moving into that, not meaning the federal government, because I've been with supporting the federal government for the past 20 years. And there seems to be a lot of interest in cloud-based HCM, especially with it has to be configurable, it has to be easy to use, it has to be mobile. Yes, mobile. Mobile's a big thing. Everyone's interested in mobile. They don't know how they're going to use it yet because the federal agencies are different how they handle mobile. We see this a lot more in the private sector, in commercial. They are faster to adopt these new technologies, but we're seeing it now come into the federal government. There's a big interest in that area of HCM.
It's interesting you talk about the trends of cloud as it kind of creeps into HR. That is the one area where one could argue that needs some modernization help. It needs some of that technology infusion so I can do my time and attendance from my phone. Are agencies get the sense that agencies understand that need, or is that being maybe a bottom-up push from the employees who are asking for it?
Now, I think the agencies are seeing that need. The difference is the systems that they have currently, 20, 30 years old. So that's a lot of them are homegrown. Some of them are off-the-shelf software. But it's the way that they're used to doing business. So they're just learning what they can do now with the newer systems. Now, I think millennials are pushing more because we have five generations in the workforce now for the first time ever. And they all work differently. And millennials, they want to be able to, like you said, go to your cell phone and enter transactions or access data without having to be in the office. They can do it on any mobile device. So I see that moving, and I think employees are pushing them a little bit.
Interesting. Now, we'll blame the millennials on something else, and that's a good time to take a quick break. My guests today are Laura Grant, the head of digital innovation for public sector at SAP, and David Vernon, the senior human capital management application specialist at SAP. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Innovation in Government, sponsored by Carahsoft on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
Cyber sabotage and ransomware are on the rise, while cloud to IoT are changing the tech landscape. How do we find clarity in this growing cyber complexity? Complex challenges call for bold solutions. Join the best and brightest cyber minds on December 5th at the annual Semantic Government Symposium in Washington, D.C. You don't want to miss this one-day event, where we'll tackle these critical issues together. Register today at semantic.com/symposium. That's semantic.com/symposium.
Tune in on Tuesdays at 10:30 a.m. and 2:30 p.m. for the Innovation in Government show sponsored by Carahsoft. Learn from industry experts who enable innovation and make government more responsive and secure by advancing key technologies. Innovation in Government examines a wide range of topics and evaluates their payoff. Cybersecurity, big data, mobility, cloud computing, and more. Innovation in Government, Tuesdays at 10:30 a.m. and 2:30 p.m. on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 a.m. Search Innovation in Government.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Innovation in Government show sponsored by Carahsoft on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guests today are Laura Grant, the head of digital innovation for public sector at SAP, and David Vernon, a senior human capital management application specialist also at SAP. Before break, we were talking a lot about the IT modernization trends and the need to really change business processes. Let's shift a little bit, and David, let me start with you. The workforce is the key piece to this. So there was a recent CIO survey that came out, and every part of that CIO survey talked about workforce, workforce, workforce. So, David, you're the workforce expert on our panel today. Talk a little bit about what's happening, what's different today beyond the fact that we're all getting older.
I'm not. No. You may be. Okay.
Well, you're the lucky one. No, you and Peter Pan.
That's right. When we talk in the federal space, and actually industry in general, we've seen a lot of change. Of course, I've seen a lot of change. The aging workforce is an issue. We had a recent GAO report, I think it was in the past year or two, that indicated that 34% of the federal workforce, total federal workforce, are eligible to retire by the year 2020. Now, when you think of that, and you're thinking of just the federal workforce, that's an enormous amount of people that you're going to have to recruit, you're going to have to train, you're going to have to hire them and get them onboarded, that type of thing. So that's a big undertaking. Now, granted, not everybody's going to retire at the same time, but it is something to start planning for and looking at. We've also seen a move away from men in the workplace, not just men in the workplace. We have more women and more minorities sharing space in the workplace than ever before. So, and everybody works differently, so they have to adapt to those changes in the workforce. We also have generational differences. We mentioned earlier that there's five generations in the workforce now for the first time ever. Each one of them works differently. So the federal government needs to have systems in place that supports how the generational work habits are different.
I think that's a great point about the five generations in the workplace, because one of the things you've seen is this push for, and this goes back to maybe what Laura was talking about, the online help, whether it's, hey, I have a question about my veterans benefits, I can do a chat or chat bot. But they also have, remember the old Pueblo, Colorado call for information, and GSA has been very good about not getting rid of their phone numbers, knowing that people work differently. How do agencies keep that in mind as they're planning to improve their services? Let me start with David on the HR side, then Laura, you jump in.
We see agencies looking towards employee service centers, knowledge bases where you can go in and search for maybe it's questions or events about benefits that have occurred, so they have a knowledge base and they can go and search and answer the question themselves. But they also have the service center that you can reach out and touch somebody and they can help you that way as well. So we see them looking to move into that area more.
And Laura, from your perspective, when you start talking about the modernization piece and business process change, that also has to play into this workforce slash improvement to serve the citizen better, because there's multiple generations out there to serve the citizen.
Correct. And it's the same thing. It's how do you provide services via a portal or via an application or an app on a phone that really meets the needs of the citizen? A citizen shouldn't have to understand your organization and how it's structured to navigate your portal. Same thing with an application. The application should push that information forward to them and make it easier to consume. So really leveraging, you know, mobility and the cloud and these portals, and as well as keeping some of these call centers around so that we meet the needs for each of these different aged citizens that are out there as well.
You reminded me of something. The citizens shouldn't have to understand how the government's organized. And back in the Bush administration time, they talked about three clicks to service. And that really begun this conversation of citizen services. And the progress has been slow. And I think part of that reason is we could blame money, you could blame technology. But again, it's the people, it's the understanding. So David, again, as our HR specialist on this one, is there a training issue here too that has to play into getting the workforce to move in a specific direction?
To get the workforce to move, I would say yes. But the way the technology is today, it's more intuitive. So you don't have to have a lot of training in order to get into a system and do certain items. I can give you an example off the wall, which is kind of like the recruiting processes in the federal government. We talk to a lot of agencies and we talk to a lot of applicants, and they feel that the recruiting processes in the federal government right now are like archaic. They're too many clicks. You have to do too many clicks in order to even to apply. There's no connection to the social network. There's no feedback, no timely feedback. So you can put in your resume to apply for a job and you may not hear anything back. And then there's an extended time in order to hire that individual. And I can give you from my own experience, because I used to work for the government, and I put in my resume and I did not hear anything back for 9 months. So it took 9 months for them to make me an offer and to get me onboarded. So they need to actually fix that process. And we've seen this in the papers recently. They are looking at fixing that process. It's faster in the commercial world, where I can actually make an interview and make an offer to a person sitting here right now and have them start today if I wanted to. That won't occur in today's federal world.
Laura, jump in.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that is so critical in the reasoning why this needs to get fixed is it's a competitive workforce. It's a competitive marketplace out there right now. Young talent coming into the government, we have this need for programmers. We have a need for data scientists. We have a need for analysts. And they don't want to work on old technology. They constantly want to work with the newer technology. They want to work in iOS, JavaScript, Python, those types of technologies. They don't want to work in COBOL. So in order to capture this workforce that wants to work for the government because they want to support the mission, they want purpose-driven work, we have to make that hiring and the application process better, because otherwise you're going to lose, they're going to take the job that gets offered to them. And if the government is taking 9 months to offer a position, they're going to lose the talent, and we can't afford that.
And I think that's being recognized in the government, though it's been recognized, I think, for the last 15 years, right, that the hiring process is broken, or at least needs to be severely improved. The CIO Council is having a hiring fair in early November, where they're kind of pre-qualifying people through the resume process and then getting those interviews and potentially doing some spot hiring. So it's good to see some innovation, if you will, even though a hiring fair is not necessarily innovation, but some movement in that direction. Laura, what's the technology side of this equation? Like you mentioned earlier about machine learning and resumes and machine learning and dealing with applicants. Are there other technology side to help the workforce, whether it's recruiting or training?
So I think the thing that the CIO councils, and they're talking this language, it's really about doing innovation on the edge. So you're going to modernize your back-end systems, your HR systems, your supply chains, your finance systems, but you need to also have an innovation platform that's going to allow you to do this innovation on the edge. It's going to really allow you to bring in the machine learning, bring in blockchain, bring in artificial intelligence, and allow that to be a part of the overall innovation and modernization process. But it's this continuous innovation that these innovation platforms need to provide, because I can't tell you what's going to come out next year in technology, right? It's changing so fast. It's very exciting.
But if you could, we could all be rich.
I know.
So why can't you?
I will try.
Okay. But you're
right. That question was asked of me by a CIO once.
What's coming next?
Yeah. What do you predict in the next 10 years?
Well, what did you say?
I said, I can't predict tomorrow.
Fair enough. David, talk a little bit about the other trends that are kind of looking into the future. As you know, if we have this conversation a year from now, what are some of those other trends that you think are going to start to take hold around HR?
Well, I know one of the areas that's really big in the federal government is they want a better, newer, more modern user experience in the when employees log into a system. So we see that that's already here, and we can do that now. So it has to be friendly, it has to be flexible, and it has to be so that you don't have to have a lot of training for the individuals that they can log in and get to things without having to go to a lot of training. We see also a push, of increased interest, I guess would be better, for employee engagement. It used to be when I worked for the federal government, I had a job, I did my job, and I went home, basically. Now you want those employees to be engaged. And you engage them because, especially like a new hire, you engage those employees because you want to get them involved in the organization, up to speed, and productive as quickly as possible. That's good because it helps the employee feel that they're contributing to the organization and that they're being heard within the organization. And we cannot discount the value of an employee feeling that they are contributing to an organization and they're being heard, because when they feel that way, they stay. And when they stay, that does nothing but improve the retention for the agency.
And it also leads them down the path of that modernization piece, because they start looking at business processes, because they're engaged, they understand it, and they go, hey, what if we did it this way? And someone goes, oh, we never thought of that. Lars, we're almost out of time, so similar question. What's the takeaway from our conversation, but also where are we going? What's the big trends?
So I think that the trends are what we had talked about, right? Bringing in machine learning, blockchain, chatbots into the enterprise, into these back-end systems. But the enabling technology is mobility and cloud, right? Because the government is starting to embrace the cloud. We're seeing the mandate coming down from Defense Secretary Mattis and making it clear that Department of Defense needs to take aggressive steps toward embracing kind of commercial cloud technologies. And they're creating a DoD cloud steering committee. But now things are changing because the technology, it's secure, it's safe, it's proven. They realize this is the way they're going to have to do things to keep the budgets under control and to continue to innovate. And then I think the mobile technology with the new workforce is really another driver in this that's really kind of shifting this move to rethink business processes and modernize all of the systems.
All right, this has been a fascinating conversation. There's a ton that you left us to think about, especially chatbots and Alexa for government employees. But unfortunately, we're out of time. I'd like to thank my guests, Laura Grant, the head of digital innovation for public sector at SAP, and David Vernon, a senior human capital management application specialist, also at SAP. Laura, David, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Innovation in Government, sponsored by Carahsoft, on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. For more on this discussion, visit federalnewsradio.com and search innovation.
Thank you for listening to the Innovation in Government Show, sponsored by Carahsoft on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The entire discussion can be found on demand at Federal News Radio, keyword innovation.